Offer valid on standard browsers, U.S. only.
When I heard about Date My Age, I thought, really? But there I was in my empty, quiet house, my laptop on the kitchen counter, and I typed in my name. Looking for a man between the ages of, 40 to 60? Sure, why not?
Date My Age is different. With verified profiles, you can feel safe and secure to explore meaningful connections with interesting and mature singles.
Date My Age made it really easy. I could join and view online profiles for free. All of a sudden, my empty house wasn't so quiet anymore. I got so much attention, it just made me feel seen and alive. Date My Age helped me start a totally new chapter in my life.
Find a friend, a lover, a partner at Date My Age. Get 60% off when you join at datemyage.com today. That's datemyage.com to connect with thousands of singles worldwide. datemyage.com.
Hello, and welcome to Long Time No See, the podcast. Each week, we'll be pairing two blindfolded comedians who've agreed to sit down with a mystery guest. I'll be putting them on the spot with a series of questions about their careers, lives, and opinions. Without further ado, please remove your blindfolds and introduce yourself.
Hey, I'm Michael.
Hi, Andrea.
I have to be honest with you, I am so relieved to see it's you.
Do you have any irrational fears? What's the worst fad you were into? Is there any job that you would be terrible at?
Underwater welder?
Don't say that about yourself.
Do you guys have any useless talents?
I kicked one of those delivery robots.
What? You kicked one?
Yelling. I kick those all the time.
They have names on them.
Good.
I can make smoke come out of my mouth with nothing.
Do it.
You want to see it?
What the f***? Are you a dragon?
Out now, Long Time No See, the podcast, season 2. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Port Arthur, Texas. Port Arthur, Texas, for lack of a better word, I guess, smells? It's an oil refinery town, and it smells like somewhere oil is refined. When I was growing up, there was a steel mill in our neighborhood, and until it shut down in the 80s, it smelled too. It smelled like somewhere where steel was milled. It's not a read, it's just true about most residential industrial areas. There's smoke and chemicals and friction and fire, and the air soaks it all in, and it gets everywhere. It surrounds everything. So much so that if you live in a place like that, you don't even notice it. It just is. Until you go someplace else, until you leave the place that you're from, you don't know that everywhere doesn't smell. Janis Joplin is from Port Arthur, Texas. It's a town of industry and family. It's on the water. It's hot. It's a lot of things. But what it wasn't in the late 1950s and early 1960s was a hotbed of art and music. And when the Cultural Revolution came calling, Port Arthur didn't exactly accept the charges. That's a collect call joke. The kids don't know. But that didn't mean that Janice's life was devoid of culture or of art. It didn't mean that she was stifled or unsupported. It just meant that she would eventually have to find out that some places smelled different. Now, by the time the public got to know her, what they saw was a wild woman with feathers in her unbrushed hair, and satin, velvet, heels, or maybe barefoot. But to her family, she was a wild child who'd gotten out of Port Arthur. In this episode of The Opus, we're going to hear from Seth and Dorothy Joplin's two youngest children, Laura and Michael. They were great. They do great work in preserving Janice's legacy. and I wanted to talk to them about their older sister. So many people at the time, and so many more now, admired Janice. But who was Janice when she was at home? And how did she fit into a refinery town when her tastes in music and art were refined in a very different way? For Consequence of Sound and Sony Legacy, I'm Jill Hopkins, and this is The Opus. When I was in my early 20s, so like 2 years ago, JK, heavy sigh, I had this great roommate who was from Kansas. And 1 year for her birthday, I got her a t-shirt that read, "Not everything in Kansas is flat," which is so classy. But this was in a time where novelty t-shirts were both age-appropriate and fashion-forward, so it was fun. I ended up, much, much later, marrying a man from a different part of Kansas. But when people are done with their Wizard of Oz jokes, they always say something about how flat it must be. There's probably a whole nother podcast somewhere about Midwesterners and our obsession with elevation, or the lack thereof. And as a Midwesterner, I think we're always just hoping someone else's landscape will make ours look more interesting by comparison. I mean, sure, we have skyscrapers here. I'm in Chicago. But, you know, you drive out of the city and you can see everything in every direction. But the Joplins will tell you first thing that their town has all of us beat. My fellow sea level dwellers, let's turn our sights to the south. Port Arthur makes Topeka look like Denver. Here's Laura Joplin. She's Janice's sister. She's about 6 years younger than Janice, the middle child. She's also the author of a biography called Dear Janice, which was the basis of the documentary Janice, Little Girl Blue.
It's flat.
Yes.
Anything you see is just flat. And it's a petroleum manufacturing area. That's our primary business. So everybody worked for it directly or indirectly, which meant it frequently smelled pretty bad because there'd be some disruption of this or that, and the unions would be on strike or not. And, you know, so in other words, it was a business town.
See, I wasn't making up the part about the town smelling weird. So don't come for me, Texas. I wasn't messing with you. We're hearing from Michael Joplin. He's Janice's youngest brother. 10 years younger.
I mean, it was flat as a pancake, and the high point was the overpass, you know, and we would go watch the sunset. But when you're up there, you see the oil refineries as far as you could see, and they were burning off excess gas on these pipes, and so it'd be lit up like crazy, all, you know, just this beautiful. It was actually stunning, and it very water oriented. I mean, there was marsh, country, hardcore. You couldn't really walk out into the country, you'd die. You know, we just kind of sink into the mud.
Yeah.
You know, it smelled really bad because of all the oil refinery, but I didn't know, you know, it's just the way it was.
Yeah.
And hot and humid, a lot of mosquitoes.
I love this picture they're painting. I mean, I just do. It's got something for all of the senses. They lived in this tidy pink framed house in a nice neighborhood, you know? Seth Joplin, he did work in the oil business. It was really difficult not to. Dorothy Joplin worked at a business college, and while their home wasn't one where Janice heard a lot of modern music, it was a home where expression was valued.
It was an unwritten rule that we all sat at the dinner table together and that everybody spoke. It didn't matter how old you were. If you weren't yet old enough to sit at a chair, you were put on top of two very thick century dictionaries so that you could be equal with everybody. And our parents made a deliberate decision to ask the children questions, and they listened, even if you were four, you know, to try to encourage people to understand they could express themselves and people would listen.
We were taught the value of the word, of the actual word. And Pop would do a, we had these big Oxford dictionaries, these double dictionaries, you know, A through J, you know, and these huge things. And every night at dinner, he'd open up one of them and just randomly point, and here's the word that you need to use today, you know, and you have to use it during dinner. And, you know, just these things. It's some random mountain in Iraq, you know, like just whatever. And so it gave all of us an innate love of the actual word. So that we were all avid readers. Janice was reading the whole time. There was always a paperback in her purse, you know, just that kind of thing.
Their memories come with their own unique points of view. But one thing both Joplin siblings want to make clear, and something that their parents have wanted to make clear since the 70s, is that all of the kids, including Janice, grew up loved and supported. Seth, in an interview from back then, said, "I've seen stories that said she ran away from home when she was 11 or 14 or 17. But she left home with our approval and our funds." He continued, "She was never alienated from the family. Although we disagreed with the way she lived, she liked us and we liked her. She came back more than I would have thought."
In this world, if you bring the papers down, you know everybody's fighting on with each other. No one you could count on, baby, not even your brother.
Now, I don't think anyone would have really blamed Janice if she didn't come home all that often. We've established that the Joplin family was straight up lovely. Nice people, loved words, I'm here for it. But her peers at the time were mostly trash. There, I said it. I don't like bullies. Don't care for it. There's a story of a now famous former NFL coach / current broadcaster who was a schoolmate of Janice's, who was relentless in his teasing. It's not the only reason I never cared for his team, but it's certainly one of them. Janice was the belle of the ball in a lot of the creative spaces she'd found in California. But in grade school and at Thomas Jefferson High, Janice was decidedly an outcast. She was in clubs and things. It's like in the glee club and stuff. But she'd skipped a grade. Look at the big brain on Janice. But it meant that she was young for her grade. Her parents thought that that may have contributed to the catching up that she may have had to do socially. When she was 14, she started dressing differently. That's the age when kids do that. But in the 1950s, whew, good luck, girl. And by her senior year, she identified with the Beatniks, which led to a lot of music discovery. Good for her. But all of this, in Texas, in the 50s, of course, had this ribbon of racial segregation baked right in. Laurel will tell you about it.
My senior year of high school, the town was formally integrated because Martin Luther King's people came in and said, either integrate or you're going to have a big problem. And so they said, okay. So my class of 676 students had 10 Black students, and only one of them stayed to graduate. But it was the beginning, and it did evolve, I think, fairly quickly to be more integrated. By the time my brother was there, I think it was more integrated. It was the South. There's one thing that I think is important about Janice, because she had problems in high school, and so she ended up finding social problems. She had some small group of girlfriends, but she really hung out with this group of guys, and they were intellectuals, and they read literature and listened to different types of music, and they would drive around in the car together listening to the radio. They'd go across the river together, you know. But that helped her get into music and a culture in a different way. One of the things that those people did, there was Houston Avenue was a kind of a dividing line, white and Black, and it was an area where there were a lot of nightclubs. Port Arthur was a big petroleum refining area and an international port. So the town tried to have social areas that would attract the sailors rather than have the sailors get into, you know, the good parts of town. So they had Houston Avenue, which was, you know, whorehouses and bars and food and music and all kinds of stuff. Well, Janice and her friends were into all those things. So as a group, they would go down when they heard a particular musician was in town or something. And there were some really good blues clubs where you could go. And Janice hung out there a lot, even though her guy friends were a year older than her. Even when she was a senior in high school, she was still going down there and absorbing a lot about the music that she later got into.
Meeting new people. Hanging out with the Blacks. It was all very exciting. And she learned so much, musically, socially. And she wanted to share with some of the few people she knew who would listen. Here's Michael.
You know, she would be playing and she's singing some Woody Guthrie thing, you know, and you go, wow, how did you get to that? You know, and because she liked the message, and that was an important, it had meaning to her. Her being drawn to that didn't surprise me at all. Make me bat an eye. Just like, oh, cool. Okay. You know, oh, that's a good one. You know, I haven't heard that, and you know, that kind of stuff. So she would turn us on and then we'd listen to that.
Yeah.
You know, have an album at the house. Oh, Joan Baez, you know, she didn't like Bob too much, but so I just remember that.
One of the only parts I really miss about being in high school, about being a teenager, was how much I loved things, how obsessed I would get about a new band or a song. And how excited I would get to discover something cool. And when you come across music that finally speaks to you, there's really nothing like it. You're like this sponge. And sometimes, like a sponge, you absorb too much and it starts to spill out. And for most of us, and for Janice at first, that spillage, I guess, just stays within our circles of our family and our friends. But Janice's voice and her tastes, the evolution of herself, were just too much for that circle, too much for Port Arthur. As it turns out, too much for Texas or the South. But don't forget, she came home when she could. She always wrote. I I really, really, truly believe that if Janis wasn't gifted or motivated enough to have become a successful singer and songwriter and performer, that she would have made a really great music writer. Like, I feel that Rolling Stone would have found a place for her writing. She's really good. She's so passionate and interested in the music that moved her. From the Odetta that she discovered during her beatnik phase to Kris Kristofferson, who, let it be said, was a great songwriter, but also that Janis thought he was cute. And she wasn't wrong. I know I said that in the last episode, but he was really cute. And she'd tell anyone who would listen about what she loved. She was a vocal cheerleader with a knack for words. It's apparent in her lyrics, but it's also there on the pages of the letters that she wrote home to her family in Port Arthur. These letters, by the way, were PG. Mom and Dad and little bro and little sis were going to be reading. But still, they were really funny and really sweet and really involved. And Michael and Laura and Dorothy and Seth looked forward to them.
They were addressed to family as a unit, and we would get a 12-page letter. I mean, you know, handwritten in ink and, you know, just sitting there, and we would read them all at dinner and passing around, and, you know, and then we'd all write back way before email. So you were, and actually way before making long-distance phone calls, because they were, like, expensive, you know, and so nobody's going to do that. You know, it had to be something important to do a long-distance call. I mean, something health-oriented or, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, dire. Otherwise, you just write it. So looking at those, you know, like 30 years after her death, Mom said to Laura, you know, I have all these letters of Janis's. Do you want to read them? You know, like, oh my God.
He's been holding out on us.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, she just kept, you know, it was like a mom, you know, it wasn't, you know, she was just keeping letters in the drawer and in a box in the closet, you know, one of those things.
Oh, we got a letter, and everybody, you know, get together and read it individually and talk about it at dinner. And, you know, there was a lot of desire and connection and enjoy and enjoyment. And she would come home, you know, for Christmas or when things got too tough somewhere, she'd come home.
Were the stories of her life shocking to you at the time? Or did she keep that part under the vest?
I was 6 years younger than her, and I was not included in the real information really till much later.
Sure.
I mean, the book Love Janis I really think I wrote it because no one would tell me what was going on, and I knew something was going on and I wanted to know.
Of course she wanted to know. Laura's book lays it all out there. And Janis was living arguably one of the most interesting lives of anyone I can think of at the time. And she was finally loved by her peers. She'd finally found a big group that got her. And with Pearl, she was finally getting to make the album that her entire life's experience had provided the material for. And she was stoked.
She was thrilled with the new band. And I think that on hearing the music, you realize, you know, she'd put something very different together, and there was so much power. And her voice and her stories were all about the excitement of the sound and loving the band, that she's finally found a group that she can work with that helps her. You know, I think it was fundamentally a shift.
Janis was making her dream album. She wasn't making her final album, not as far as she knew, and she was looking forward to sharing it with the world. Michael was nearing the end of his high school career in 1970. He was, of course, like most American young men at the time, worried about the draft. But he was also concerned about his sister. You can do both. Her letters home were some of her experiences, but he had access to a newsstand, and the media told bigger stories than the one she kind of sanitized to send home. Not all of them were true or fair, but they all told a story of a life of excess. But he knew his sister well enough and loved her enough to believe her when she told him about the future she wanted, about her excitement for this album and the tour, and how much fun it would be if he joined her. Of course, the draft. It's breathing down your neck. The Vietnam War was the story. The draft was the story. But maybe he could just take his sister up on a very generous offer.
Janice said, come on tour with me. You know, after you graduate high school, we're going to go, you're going to go tour with me. You can be a roadie. And, you know, like I was, that was my aspiration at the time, you know, to go be on tour. And it just seemed like, oh, you know, women and it'd be awesome. You know, I'd have a great time.
Now, the Joplin family did get the opportunity before Janice died to see her play live. And I don't know, it's always weird when your folks show up to the gig. Especially if your onstage persona isn't your dinner table persona. Especially if your folks don't know how other people see you. But they did. They got to go. They got to see her. Here's Michael talking about his experience at the Janis Joplin show.
We went to see her in Houston and as a family. And that was, she got us great seats. We're on the front row or whatever, you know. And I'm looking back like, oh, my God. You know, I hardly watched her at all because it's like, well, it was just Janis. Didn't like, you know, she had some goofy clothes on, whatever. You know, I'm just like, you know, everybody's paying attention, you know, and that was fascinating. In Port Arthur, she wasn't that big other than being a local celebrity because the music was still kind of twangy and a little bit country, not even much blues or anything. But that was the radio. But the first time I heard her on the radio was fascinating. You know, I'm at work at Baskin Robbins and my sister comes on the radio. You know, it was like freaking awesome. The parents were definitely worried, very proud and definitely worried.
And here's Laura.
My parents just had to see for themselves that she was okay. And I remember sitting in the audience. It wasn't a huge audience and we'd gone early, and, you know, sitting on the floor. And I remember having on a navy blue Dacron double knit dress, the only person in a dress in the audience. and just watching. And you could see because people are dressed differently and their hair was different. And the music on stage wasn't, you know, it was tight and it was together and it was powerful, but it wasn't the same as the type of music that came on the radio in Port Arthur. So you could see the new and the different. And what was so special is that you could see in her face this incredible joy, elation, power, freedom, that she'd found a place for herself and she loved it. And she loved the fact that the parents would come out. And I do remember, I think my parents talking together somewhere after that saying, you know, I don't think we're going to have much influence anymore.
So they knew what she could do. And I'm so, so glad that they were able to witness it firsthand. The letters couldn't have accurately portrayed what she was like on stage. You know, we didn't have YouTube back then. I know. So it makes me really glad to know that the people who knew her the best got to see her do what she did best. I pulled my harpoon out of my dirty red bandana. I was playing soft while Bobby sang the blues.
You know, most peak times when somebody in your family dies, they kind of go away, and, you know, after a while. And there's memories, fun, remembrances, and all that. You know, but I'm here 50 years later, and I'm an old guy now. We're sitting there talking about this, and it's utterly weird, you know. But all these guys that knew her, like Chris and the band guys, and from Full Tilt, from every band, like protect her like crazy. You know, if they get requested for interviews, they, is it okay if I talk to these people? And I go, hey, you know, I talk to whoever you want. I've never said no. You know, I just, they just, this protection thing. And it's so heartwarming in so many respects like that, that I felt she's protected without us doing anything. No, I mean, she slept around. She did massive amounts of drugs. She died of a drug overdose. What am I protecting? You know, like, you know, her reputation is half her fame.
Joan Jett would make it known a whole decade later that she didn't give a damn about her bad reputation. I don't know if Janis ever said those words, but she lived those words. Losing a sibling is a very unique pain. And everybody was so young. That's an even more unique pain. But Laura and Michael and their parents, Seth and Dorothy, got Janis longer than any of the rest of us. Lucky. Her fans lost her public persona, but her family lost all of her. The talent, the quirks, the rebellion, the prose, and the love. In the next episode of The Opus, we'll talk about the last days of Pearl and the last days of Janis, and what becomes of an album when its artist is gone, but the public's desire is bigger than ever. Let me leave you with one last story from Michael that I think would crack Janis the hell up.
This guy ran up to me at some events and, you gotta see my new tattoo. I got a tattoo of your sister. And he showed me this giant thing on his arm, but it's my sister naked. And
The necklaces photograph and everything? Yeah. Oh, you know, it's sitting on right. My desk right now.
Okay. I mean, it's a famous thing. It's beautiful, you know. And I go, wow, that's awesome. Do you have any pictures of your naked sister you can send me? And,
you know, like. Okay, it cracked me up anyway. And I hope you thought it was funny, too. For Consequence of Sound and Sony Legacy, I'm Jill Hopkins, and this is The Opus. I'll see you next time. Drinks are on Pearl.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Don't you deserve a Medicare plan you can count on? Well, you can count on a Medicare Advantage plan from United Healthcare. Enjoy reliable coverage and low out-of-pocket costs with a Medicare Advantage plan from United Healthcare. And if you have a chronic condition like diabetes, chronic heart failure, or a cardiovascular disorder, you may qualify for a United Healthcare Complete Care plan with plans that fit your life today and as your needs change tomorrow. Find out more about United Healthcare plans at uhc.com/Medicare.
Hey, I'm Nancy Wilson.
Mike Campbell. Mark Mothersbaugh from Devo.
Hey, it's Adam from Counting Crows, and I am here giving you the story behind the song.
The Story Behind the Song is back for season 4. I'm Peter Chotti of Deep Cuts Media, and this season we're diving even deeper into some of music history's most iconic tracks with the legends who made them.
What's so beautiful about it is a lot of people connect with, you gotta live your life and don't let the big man push you down. Don't have to live like a refugee, can't keep fighting for what you believe. And that was Tom.
From the spark of inspiration to untold tales from the studio, we unlock the true stories that shape the music you love.
At the time on the radio, there was a really cool riff by Nazareth covering a Joni Mitchell song, This Flight Tonight. It had the same groove, but I think Barracuda kind of blew it out of the water.
Join us as we all sit down with music icons like Devo, Heart, Mike Campbell of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, Sublime, Counting Crows, and so many more. New episodes are out now from the Consequence Podcast Network, so tune in wherever you get your podcast and join me for the story behind the song.
Plan on flying? It's time to upgrade to a real ID. Because in order to board domestic flights, your driver's license or state-issued ID must be a real ID, or you'll need another acceptable form of identification. So don't wait. Find out how to get your real ID at tsa.gov/real ID. That's tsa.gov/real ID. Or visit your local DMV. And then you'll be cleared for takeoff.